From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Attorneys are making their closing arguments right now in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin. Chauvin is charged with killing George Floyd, a black man whose death has sparked worldwide protests against police violence and racism. Here's how defense attorney Eric Nelson addressed the jury today.
The state has the burden of proving each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt. But if they are missing any one single element, it is a not guilty verdict.
We're joined now by NPR national correspondent Cheryl Corley, who is in Minneapolis. And Cheryl, let's hear from prosecutor Steve Slesher on closing arguments this morning, speaking about how long former officer Chauvin pinned George Floyd's neck beneath his knee.
When he was unable to speak, the defendant continued. When he was unable to breathe, the defendant continued. Beyond the point that he had a pulse, the defendant continued this assault 9 minutes and 29 seconds.
Cheryl, the prosecution marshaled dozens of witnesses, many videos. It all comes down to today. What did they focus on in their last opportunity to sway the jury?
Well, as Stephen Schischler said, that 9 minutes and 29 seconds is a lot of what they focused on. This was just a really powerful recap of what the jurors have heard. They have heard 38 witnesses and an extensive replay of varying videos, as you mentioned, being shown about George Floyd's death throughout this trial. And the prosecutor said, Schischler said George Floyd should not have died that day, but because the defendant, Derek Chauvin, decided to put his knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, that George Floyd died. And he says this was not policing, but an assault. And he said the state doesn't have to prove that Derek Chauvin intended to kill George Floyd, but it does have to prove that Derek Chauvin applied force to George Floyd, and it wasn't an accident, but it was on purpose. So that was pretty much the gist of their closing argument.
Right, but just a reminder for folks, I mean, the burden of proof is on the state. It could all take just one dissent from a hung jury, for a hung jury, basically. How has the defense tried to make the case for reasonable doubt?
Well, for the most part, the defense has argued that George Floyd did not die at the hands of Derek Chauvin. And they say that it was drug use in part, that George Floyd had heart problems, that it was those complicating factors that caused George Floyd's death. And essentially, they've also argued that Derek Chauvin was following police protocol. That's sort of an uphill battle for Derek Chauvin and his defense attorney, Eric Nelson, since there were a number of police officers, including the police chief, who testified against Derek Chauvin, saying that he didn't follow training or police policy and that what he did was well beyond reasonable use of force. But that's an argument that the defense has brought up, and it also presented, medical experts who presented conflicting testimony from others who said that it was, shallow breathing or a lack of oxygen that caused George Floyd's death. So we'll have to see, which version the jury goes with. And as you mentioned, it's reasonable doubt can take one juror to go with the defense, which, could alter whatever the decision could be.
I have less than a minute with you, Cheryl, but the jury will be sequestered. They could deliberate for hours or a few weeks. And we know that police rarely get convicted in these cases. What should we expect in the coming days?
Well, I'm not sure. it's a mixture of anticipation, perhaps some dread. For the jury, it's going to be a very detailed look at each of these counts. For as the judge told them during jury instructions, it's going to be a case-by-case look at each of those counts, and Chauvin can be found guilty or innocent of any of the three charges that he faces.
That's NPR's Cheryl Corley. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, to Chicago now, where protesters continue to mourn and express anger over the fatal police shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo on March 29th. Police were responding to reports of gunshots. Security video shows Adam walking with an older young man who was shooting at different targets. Police say they believe the boy also had a gun as they chased him down an alley. And footage released last week does show him tossing something away seconds before he turns and faces the pursuing officer with his arms raised. In that split second, the officer shot him in the chest. A gut-wrenching tragedy. But in the wake of the shooting, Mayor Lori Lightfoot and other officials condemned gangs, even though there's no confirmation that Adam Toledo belonged to one. And others have asked, what was a 13-year-old doing out at 2:30 in the morning with an older kid and a gun? Well, Berto Aguayo is executive director of the Chicago anti-violence program Increase the Peace. And Berto, some of the neighborhood who attended memorials for Adam over the weekend mourned him, were also bothered by the thought of him out in the early morning. You wrote an op-ed for Southside Weekly headlined, "We Are Adam Toledo," that seemed to address some of those questions. What was the point you wanted to make?
I think ultimately the point that I want to get across is that the issue of police and street violence at its core is caused by the same issue, which is the lack of investment in our young people and the lack of investment in our communities, specifically in the south side of Chicago. You know, I had a similar story to Adam growing up, and there's a lot of Adams in our community. And I think ultimately what I wanted to get across is that we are losing our future because of the lack of investment that we're making in our young people. And the lack of opportunities that we're giving them. And ultimately, that's the point that I wanted to get across.
Yeah. Like you, many of these young men have single moms, have, you know, who have absolutely no money. I think you said in your op-ed that at least you were playing soccer for a while, but even that got too expensive. Gangs gave you and others structure, somewhere to go, something to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when we look at inner city youth, we look at inner city communities like the ones that exist in the south side of Chicago. We know that when there's no safe spaces to go to, when there's no after school programs, when things like soccer or art classes are no longer accessible to our young people, you know, street gangs fill that void. You know, they provide that sense of belonging to a kid who is coming home to an empty house because their mom has to work day in and day out just to be a provider. And I think ultimately, we have to acknowledge that we as a society failed Adam, and that in order to prevent more of these tragedies, we need to be able to fill the void ourselves. We need to be able to, instead of giving 40% of our budget to a police department that's just going to react to violence, giving some of that money to schools and things that will prevent violence, mental health resources, violence domestic counseling and help for families, really provide that social safety net that's missing, that doesn't allow young men of color to make mistakes and still be alive, because that is the possibility that's afforded to a lot of people and communities that are not communities of color.
Well, and you're not completely absolving the police here, although some in the Latino community, especially in this neighborhood, have expressed sympathy with the notion that this young man might have just tossed a gun away when he turned. But you're saying those who have negative comments about Adam Toledo have to kind of check their thinking because they give other kids, white kids, a break. Give that example.
Yeah, well, you just look at the example of Kyle Rittenhouse, who was 18 years old, far older than Adam Toledo, carrying an AR-15, killing two people. He's given water bottles and escorted by police out of the scene, right? He escapes with his life after committing these crimes. Adam Toledo tosses a gun, puts his hands up, and complies with the police officer's orders and is still killed. And regardless of whether he was a good kid or a bad kid, his life mattered just as much as any other young person in our community's life matters. Ultimately, young men of color in our communities, people of color, you know, they're not afforded the benefit of the doubt. They're not afforded the presumption of innocence, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, they are demonized and vilified.
Well, and again, you're calling for money to be invested. Just to, again, tick through some of the other suggestions that you have. Summer is coming. Programs that could give kids a place to go.
Yeah, as I mentioned in my op-ed, the only reason why I'm speaking here today and I'm not dead or in jail is because my mom and a grocery store owner agreed to go into a partnership where my mom would pay part of my wage when I was 14 years old to work at a grocery store. She wanted just to keep me busy. And I think as summer's coming, what we need to do is a massive investment in our young people so that we give them jobs that are good paying jobs, not just in the summer, but year round. We can be providing them so many engaging opportunities, but we fail to do so because we lack the political courage to actually make those decisions and make those investments in our young people. And that means taking money away from the police department.
I just have to underscore what you said. Your mom knew you needed to get off the streets. She asked the grocer, please employ you. He said, I don't have any money. And she said, I'll help you pay him so that you could have a job. No single mom should have to do that. Berta Aguayo, Executive Director of the Chicago Anti-Violence Program, Increase the Peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
For the second year, we're participating in a global journalism collaboration to strengthen coverage of climate change. It's called Covering Climate Now. And in today's segment, are you ready to give up your gas cooktop or switch out your gas-powered heater for an electric heat pump? For years, natural gas has been positioned as a cleaner alternative to coal, and it might be. But government stats show a full third of carbon emissions in this country, a third, come from natural gas. It's used to produce electricity in turbines or to heat homes. Half of all U.S. homes use natural gas for heating and cooking. In fact, 180 million people and 6 million businesses now rely on natural gas. But in the last 2 years, about 40 California towns and cities have banned gas hookups in new construction. Berkeley was the first in 2019. And there are also states, Arizona, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, that have passed laws making it illegal to ban natural gas. So some tension there. Mike Henschen is with the not-for-profit bipartisan Rocky Mountain Institute, where he specializes in decarbonization. Mike, tell us more about these gas emissions.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Robin. So natural gas is a fossil fuel that causes climate change. And those emissions add up. That's about 600 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions every year that come from those sources.
And so talk about how to convert or change this. And is there a messaging problem there? Because people believe that natural gas is actually something that reduces carbon emissions.
So, you know, there's a bit of a perception. If you've seen the garbage truck roll down your street, on the side of the truck, it might say runs on clean burning natural gas. You know, there's some advantages compared to diesel fuel in a truck or compared to coal at a power plant. But at the end of the day, that natural gas is contributing significant carbon pollution that's driving climate change. And what we're looking at as far as alternatives is a switch to electricity, you know, instead of being, you know, a little bit better in terms of emissions compared to coal or oil, electricity can take us all the way to zero.
Well, how do you make that change? We're talking about infrastructure, right? And the U.S. spends billions every year on old pipes or gas infrastructure. Are you saying it's time to say, no, don't rebuild, replace?
Yeah, and there's a couple ways to look at that. When we talk about gas infrastructure, in 2019, gas utilities across the U.S. spent over $20 billion. You know, 10 years earlier, that number was just $5 billion. And some of that's for entirely new systems. If someone's building a whole new neighborhood, that's sort of the easiest one to avoid because it's easiest to build something the right way the first time. But even in cities like Chicago, where the utility is 10 years into a 30-year program to replace every gas line in the city, we're seeing gas rates go up in Chicago. And people are starting to ask this question, are we, you know, sinking another 20 or more years of investment and billions of dollars into a system that's just not compatible with the idea of carbon neutral economy? And so we do have the opportunity, instead of spending that money, to invest it instead in clean energy alternatives, help expand solar and wind and use that to power electric equipment in people's homes and businesses.
Well, what about opponents? We mentioned states that are banning bans on natural gas. There are people who are going to try to protect natural gas. How do you overcome that?
Well, yeah. So we see certainly the folks in the industries that produce and sell gas are opposing efforts to reduce its use. They're in business to sell gas. But we've also got an expansion of the elected leaders who ran on climate in many cases. I mean, we see in the Biden administration's infrastructure plan a big investment in affordable housing to upgrade existing buildings and help switch them to become zero emissions and, you know, invest in our communities and places where people live.
What do you do about people who love cooking on all cylinders, and they mean gas, people who like to have the flame there? This is a sacred thing to some cooks.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's a few things to say there. One is that only about 1 in 3 households in the U.S. has gas cooking. But for those 1/3 who are, there's plenty of alternatives. We see the newer electric induction cooktops consistently getting top marks in things like Consumer Reports when they rate the top 10 cooktops on the market. You see more and more chefs who are talking about it on TV or Instagram or whatever, using electric induction cooktop, and it's got the same or better controllability. You can boil a pot of water more quickly than you can with gas, and it'll take time for people's preferences to shift. But we're also finding that there's other reasons people will make that change, and one of them is health. There's research out there that kids who live in a home with a gas stove are more likely to experience asthma. And I think people are becoming more aware that burning a fuel in the middle of your kitchen is harmful and produces pollution inside your house. So I think we'll see those preferences shift.
Some places like Denver are maybe working their way towards that. They've got a half ban. They allow gas cooking but ban gas heating. Real quick, climate scientists say we have to limit temperature rise to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit to maintain a livable climate. Where are we now?
Yeah, well, we're well on our way to busting the budget for that. We've already exceeded 1, and we've already baked in a certain amount of additional warming because we've put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And, you know, the benchmark we should be thinking about is that we need to cut our emissions in half by 2030 to have a shot at that target. And so if we really want to see the country get on track, if we see big new commitments out of the Biden administration, that's going to rely on burning a whole lot less fossil fuels all across our economy, including in the furnaces in our basements.
And our stovetops. Mike Henschen of the not-for-profit Rocky Mountain Institute, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, among those fighting gas bans is the California restaurant industry. It sued Berkeley, California, only 6 weeks before that town's new ordinance took effect last year. And chefs like Nick Kobaruvius are watching closely. He's co-owner of Sun's Edition in San Francisco. He's also opening a new restaurant. Nick, chefs get emotional about gas. How important is it?
Yeah, I mean, gas is sort of the preferred method for years. So yeah, I understand when some chefs are pushing back really hard for certain techniques and certain types of cuisine. Gas is part of the food itself.
Yeah, well, seeing a flame, you know exactly what the heat is. It's so different than seeing a red lit stovetop.
Yeah, right. You're able to get a much quicker reaction than, say, induction burners or electric. And you're able to sort of finesse it a bit more, in my experience.
Well, and what else are you and other chefs considering when it comes to sustainability?
I mean, specifically with electric, when I think of sort of initial problems, to me immediately, of course, living in San Francisco for the last, you know, 20 years, in the recent years, I think about power outages, wildfire, PG&E going down. I worry about, you know, what if the grid goes down? And, you know, what happens if there's rolling blackouts? I get concerned about that kind of stuff because for us, because our cash flow is so, so small and costs are so great here, you know, a bad week, a power outage week could really, really affect from a business side of it. I also worry about the cost. I mean, margins in restaurants are really small, you know, nationwide. And especially in a place like San Francisco, it's just magnified. So the cost of electricity is concerning for me. I know gas is a much cheaper option. And if there's a potential to sort of balance that out, you know, with rebates or whatever. I think, you know, there's certainly an opportunity. And then, you know, also the technique of what we're doing, like you alluded to earlier, live fire cooking is not limitless, but grills or, you know, I think about like wok stations for people who own, say, an Asian restaurant. I'm not aware of anything that can sort of replicate that.
Because woks have to really be heated. If you're using an electric burner, you have to wait for it to cool down if you're turning it down, or heat up if you're heating it up. But we know, and we've just heard about what gas does to the atmosphere. Is there a part of you that wants to be part of this idea of reducing emissions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. We want to be a part of this because, frankly, I think if pandemic life has taught us anything, being overly rigid, you're not going to last. And I think one of the great things about being in our industry is, you know, restaurant people are survivors, versatile and super quick to adapt. At Sun's Edition, we flipped to accommodate things like to-go orders, delivery platforms. And we did that, you know, within a few weeks. And we understand that we're going to have to adapt and evolve. It's just going to take some sort of mental gymnastics to sort of work around your menu and concept. And is it going to affect the number of employees you have, stuff like that? I think that's what's concerning. And I definitely don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
You know, we wish you luck opening a new restaurant in a pandemic and then also wanting to do the right thing and abide by restrictions on gas cooking.
You know, my wife and I talk about this all the time, like trying to balance this thing. You know, it's similar to why you use good meat instead of bad meat. But, you know, we're always trying to make the right decision, not necessarily even for profitability or anything, just to try and not screw up the world too much.
That's a good goal, a noble goal. Well, everybody in the San Francisco area, go to Sun's Edition there. We've been talking to chef and co-owner Nick Kobaruvius. Nick, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So we might have to wean off cooking with gas. And we'll link you to our look at electric heat pumps at hereandnow.org.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Supporters of the imprisoned Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny are warning about the state of his health. Navalny's lawyers are demanding he be moved to intensive care from the penal colony, where he's been on a hunger strike for weeks. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is following this story from Moscow. And Sarah, how bad is Navalny's health, as you can tell right now?
Well, his supporters have been sounding the alarm for the last couple of days. And in fact, they've been using really quite dramatic language, talking about his life hanging by a thread. They're citing some blood test results which appear to show particularly high levels of potassium, which doctors are saying could indicate potential kidney problems and even perhaps a cardiac arrest. So they've really been pointing to that and saying it's time to act to ensure that Alexei Navalny's life is not ended, and that indeed 20 days into his hunger strike, his demands are met. And remember, he's calling for an independent doctor, a doctor he can trust, to be admitted to the prison to see him, to examine him, because he's been complaining of acute back pain and also numbness in his legs and his arms. And of course, that's a particular concern for a man who just last year was poisoned with a nerve agent and spent months recovering in Germany.
20 days, that's how long, as you mentioned, he's been on a hunger strike. What are Russian authorities specifically saying about all of this, and specifically his condition?
Well, the prison authorities have just issued a very short statement, presumably in response to these rather alarmist calls from Mr. Navalny's supporters. And they've said that his condition is satisfactory. But they have said that after prison doctors, a group of them, examined Mr. Navalny, they did take this decision to move him to a different prison, which does have a hospital. It's interesting that every time the Kremlin or senior government officials here are asked about Mr. Navalny's health, they really just shrug it off. In fact, the Kremlin spokesman says this is nothing to do with the Kremlin. We're not even monitoring the health of individual prisoners. So really trying to play down who Mr. Navalny is and the significance of his hunger strike and his protest. But at the same time, we've seen increasing calls from the international community warning that there will be serious consequences if anything happens to Mr. Navalny.
Right. And in fact, the United States has warned Russia of serious consequences if Navalny dies in prison. We know the European Union foreign ministers are actually scheduled to meet soon to discuss this case. How do you think these latest developments specifically will affect the diplomatic situation around Navalny?
Well, there has been an awful lot of pressure, I think, on the Russian authorities to ensure that nothing terrible happens to Mr. Navalny. And we should bear in mind that there have been a number of high-profile prisoners who staged hunger strikes in the past, and they generally end up either being threatened with force feeding or indeed being force fed. So I think it's unlikely that the Kremlin would want, in the ultimate scenario, to see Alexei Navalny actually starve himself to death. I think there would be some kind of intervention. But obviously, you know, this has put focus and attention very much on this most famous of Russian prisoners. And his supporters are calling for mass protests right across the country to take place on Wednesday. You know, if the Kremlin was hoping that by removing him from the scene, that would be the end of his role in Russian politics, then clearly, you know, his team have other ideas.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Black girls are disciplined more harshly than their white peers, according to the National Women's Law Center, for things like dress code violations and hairstyles. This leads to more suspensions, increasing the school-to-confinement pipeline. Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat representing Massachusetts, is reintroducing a bill that seeks to end the disproportionate punishment of girls of color in schools. Congresswoman Pressley joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Yes. Yeah, so you first presented this bill in 2019. It aims to end the school to confinement pipeline, which disproportionately impacts girls of color starting as early as preschool. How does this play out in schools across the country?
Well, first, let me just say this. We find ourselves in this moment of reckoning on racial injustice, and we have to be active in the dismantling of systems of oppression. And that needs to include the discriminatory policies which criminalize adolescent behavior and disproportionately impact girls of color. This is more than a matter of inequity. It's a crisis in and of itself, which is why I introduced the Ending Push Out Act in order to establish these trauma-informed policies in our schools and to create an ecosystem where our girls can heal and they can thrive. Our schools have got to be places and spaces for learning and growth. But for too many Black and brown girls, interactions with racist dress code policies, hair policies, law enforcement in our schools has really defined their experience. You know, even during the pandemic, we have still seen horrific instances of Black girls being brutalized. And we've even seen virtually that the behavior of Black and brown girls is still being criminalized.
Yeah, you were actually inspired to reintroduce this after ProPublica's report on a Black teenage girl in Michigan who was incarcerated for not doing her homework during this pandemic. Can you explain more how this pandemic and distance learning more broadly has actually worsened this issue that we're talking about?
Sure. The pandemic has only exposed how disconnected schools are from their most vulnerable students. And it's just highlighted the extent to which Black girls are policed in their learning environments, even when they aren't attending in-person school full time. So in Michigan last year, as you were alluding to, a 15-year-old Black girl named Grace, she was incarcerated for not completing her homework and getting up late for online school. Now, thankfully, we were ultimately able to see her released, but her story is part of a larger pattern of the criminalizing of Black girls for minor misbehavior at school. So just a little bit about what the bill would do, would provide resources for counseling, mental health programs, trauma-informed care programs that are necessary to prevent push-out and then to heal the social, emotional wounds of push-out.
You brought up policies like dress codes. These types of policies are often foundational to school discipline policies. Your bill includes $2.5 billion in grant funding to schools that remove disciplinary policies for dress code and grooming violations. You know, one might argue, though, well, if dress code violations are off the table, how do we instill order? Have school districts weighed in on some of your ideas?
So what brought me to this issue, other than my own lived experience, you know, I'm a Black woman, but I was a Black girl, you know, so I certainly have had my own experiences. But what brought me to this and the recognition of just how systemic these disparities are is when a pair of girls in Malden, Massachusetts, received detention and suspensions for violating the school dress code related to their hair extensions. And so in response to that, I convened evidence-based focus groups with 100 girls. And my thought partner in that work was Dr. Monique Morris from the National Black Women's Justice Institute and the author of Push Out. So we gathered these 100 girls across all school models, private, parochial, charter, and we heard their stories. And the overall drumbeat was the same: feelings of unworthiness, being stereotyped, experiences of being silenced and shamed. And so those stories became the foundation for my Ending Push Out Act. But more directly, what happened is that we engaged also educators and anyone in the learning community that has an interaction with Black and brown girls. And then we produced a report to get them to recognize that these policies that on their face appear to be gender and race neutral are actually having a disparate impact. In fact, late last year, the Appleseed Network, they released a report that Black girls in Massachusetts are nearly four times more likely to face school discipline than white girls.
Representative Presley, I want to talk about the through line here and what we're dealing with in our current moment with this recent spat of killings by police. The country is following the Derek Chauvin trial, as well as the case of 13-year-old Adam Toledo out of Chicago. As you've just explained, the criminalization of people of color often starts in school when these young Black men and women are kids. What will your bill do to disrupt this cycle?
I want to underscore that what you just said there, when they are kids. See, with Adam Toledo, it's probably the example that comes most immediately to mind. She had another demonstration of how kids of color are adultified. So not only criminalized, but adultified. And the convergence of those two things has resulted in dire consequences. It has resulted in loss of life. It has resulted in trauma. It has resulted in a growing school to confinement pathway. When it comes to Black girls, more Black girls are just as involved than ever before. We have an unprecedented number of women who are incarcerated. And so the End Push Out Act, in that it will incentivize schools, plus with the data component, to end these discriminatory discipline practices, which are disrupting the education of Black girls and contributing to the school to confinement pathway. So I think the first thing is that it's with the data, it's shining a light to prompt those corrections and those reforms in real time. And then the fact that the bill does provide the necessary, you know, sort of using the power of the purse, resourcing through these federal grants to support states and schools that will commit to banning unfair and discriminatory discipline practices. Again, that it protects the civil rights data collection. It strengthens the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, which is really critical. And then it establishes a federal interagency task force to end the school push-out crisis and its impact on girls of color.
And listening to you over the last few months, you've been calling for trauma-informed policies that replaces these systems of harm with systems that center justice and healing, as you say. But you also acknowledge that there's not one piece of legislation that will actually undo centuries of hurt. And I'm thinking about these efforts that you're up against, like Georgia Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's America First Caucus. In this context, we're not talking about lawmakers with different focus areas. We're talking about a completely different outlook on the state of the country.
That's right.
In this effort to reach across the aisle on these important issues, like gun control legislation, for instance, how do you reconcile this? How do you find common ground for the good of all Americans?
We're really at an inflection point. And, you know, what I seek to do in that work of legislating to disrupt and to interrupt those systems of oppression, which have caused great hurt and harm that were legislated, is just to center the humanity and the dignity of all people and to be responsive to their needs. Whether we're talking about an infrastructure bill, gun reform, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, voting rights, or combating police brutality and dismantling mass incarceration. And that is why I keep returning to the prophetic words of Reverend Barber, that if we are truly in a moment of reckoning, where if you grow up in the church, then you know that is something of epic biblical proportion. What will our response be that is commensurate to that reckoning? It must be a reconstruction. And that's the phase that we're entering into right now. So yes, we absolutely need to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Bill and voting rights and the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act and many more. This is not a one and done situation. We have to undo centuries of hurt and harm that were legislated, that have been codified in statutes. So this is going to take a multi-legislative approach, and it is going to take political will and courage.
That's Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat representing Massachusetts. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Israel is no longer requiring people to wear masks outside because more than half the country is fully vaccinated, according to reports, and new infections have been greatly curbed. In the U.S., just a quarter of the population is fully vaccinated. But Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic, says it may be time for the states to follow Israel's lead and stop requiring masks outside if people aren't, say, yelling in each other's faces at a sporting event. Derek joins us now. Hi.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's see if I've got this right. You say Americans need some off-ramps from this pandemic, some sense there is an exit. Now, we want to say you're not screaming hysterically about liberties like Congressman Jim Jordan did at Dr. Fauci last week. You know, give me an end date for all of this. You're making the case for getting rid of just outdoor mask mandates to be less confusing. Explain that.
Yeah, my thesis statement here is the same thesis statement that I've had throughout the pandemic. We should fight this virus where it lives, and we should not fight this virus where it doesn't live. So where this virus lives and thrives is inside. It mostly spreads through the air in unventilated areas where people are talking or otherwise breathing heavily, like singing or working out. Where the virus doesn't thrive is outside, especially when people are walking alone. If you're in a park, if you're in an uncrowded street, you really pose a vanishingly small risk to the public. So my point here is pretty clear. As we vaccinate more and more people, indoor mask mandates remain good because, again, this virus spreads inside. But we should start to think about creating thresholds below which, in, say, local vaccinations or hospitalizations, below which we lift these outdoor mask mandates, which do not seem to fight the virus where it actually thrives.
You say it's weird to be indoors in a restaurant and see people outside with masks, but people inside without them. It's like wearing your seatbelt when the car is off, you say. Others, you spoke to an epidemiologist who compared it to wearing a condom all the time, you know, just in case. But Derek, as you know, there's the old, you can be fully vaccinated and still have some virus in your nose question, with three quarters of Americans not fully vaccinated. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday on CNN in support of outdoor masks.
In a certain situation, one can get vaccinated, have no clinical disease at all, but get infected and not even know it, and have replication of virus in your nasopharynx and inadvertently transmit it to somebody else who might actually be unvaccinated and get ill. That's the reason why you want to wear a mask then.
You see, you know, you address that. You say, but that's an infinitesimal chance of passing it on. But, you know, address that if you want. But also another thing you write about, because shouldn't we wear masks outside as a sign of solidarity? You know, a sign that we believe in science.
Sure. Yeah. Let me try to take that all at once. I think the risk that a vaccinated person is transmitting the virus is very, very small. And I think the risk of outdoor transmission is also very, very small. So the risk that an outdoors person who is vaccinated is transmitting this virus effectively is, you know, you can add up those varies there. I think I said four of them. Very, very, very small. I think that rules should have reasons. And there is a reason to wear your mask inside. And there is a reason to wear masks in large crowds. But based on the epidemiologists that I spoke to and epidemiologists that are writing about this more, there is not a very good reason to wear a mask, especially when you are alone or walking down an uncrowded street. So I just think that states should start thinking about inverting the rules that we currently have. Rather than say masks are required in most circumstances except for XYZ, we should say, look, masks are required inside, but outside, for the most part, we're not going to mandate it. I think that is a perfectly safe rule that still manages to protect all the people we want to protect, the vulnerable, the immunocompromised, the elderly, and really everyone. We don't need outdoor mask mandates to do this.
Well, here's where you come, as you always do, Derek Thompson, to that extra piece of information here, that extra level of thinking, which is those epidemiologists that you spoke with, some of them said that when they spoke to male mask skeptics, these people who were skeptics responded better to wearing masks indoors when given a break on the outdoors.
Right. So I think a lot of people think that mask wearing outside has only positive spillover effects, only positive ways of reminding each other that the pandemic is still happening. But some people that I talked to said, no, there are negative spillover effects. If there's a rule that doesn't seem to make sense to people, they might throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, I reject masks entirely. Or, you know, Julia Marcus, epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School, also told me, I thought this was a fantastic point, a lot of people that are regulating the outdoors, that are shutting down playgrounds or parks or requiring permanent mask wearing outside, these are people who have yards. And they can spend time without a mask in their own yard with their own friends while requiring that less affluent people must go outside with their face covered. Mm. And that isn't particularly fair, and it doesn't have a particularly strong epidemiological basis.
Right.
I think we can protect ourselves while being smart and science-based, and I think that that means we can build this off-ramp to a world without outdoor mask mandates.
Well, and as you write, people who are skeptics, if they get a little bit of wiggle room in one place and it makes sense to them, they're more likely to wear them in another place. Mm-hmm. Just great. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
Always gets us thinking. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.